On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, May 10th, the Make Your Own Dang Breakfast Edition. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 16, Teddy, who is 15, and my stepdaughter Lily, who is 17.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I'm the father of Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 15.
And I'm Dan Coyce. I'm an editor at Slate in Arlington, Virginia. I'm the dad to Lyra, who just turned 13. Happy birthday, Lyra. And Harper, who is 10.
And you are the dad of the Mom and Dad Are Fighting, the original, like, OG dad.
I was the mom, actually. Allison was the dad, really, if you break down how we related to each other.
Well, Gabe is off this week, but don't worry, listeners. He will be back next time. Today, we'll be discussing a listener question about sensitive kids and mental health. Plus, as always, recommendations and triumphs and fails. And in Slate Plus, we ask, does parenting make you more efficient at work? But first, we will talk about triumphs and fails. Carvel, what do you have this week, a triumph or a fail?
I have a fail, which is that this morning stuff with my dearly beloved son is so frustrating. And we reached another, like, nadir again after nadir, after multiple nadirs. This is the multiple nadir episode. And we have to leave the house at 8:05. That is the thing. And the past, like, 3 days, it has not happened. He's, like, stumbled down at 8:10 and then stumbled into the car at 8:15 and then forgotten his belt and then needed to go. And it's just, it got so bad. And yesterday, he got in the car and was like, "Don't tell me, like, don't even talk about being late. It's not going to help. I'm just going to be late." And I was just like, "But you, that's like," I just was at a loss for words, and my frustration reached a peak, and I completely lost it on him before he got out of the car. He was like, "It's George's fault. It's your fault. I didn't do anything. Like, you always blame it on me, but it's not me." And I'm like, "No, it's 100% you. And if you don't believe me, try to come down on time and see if we don't magically get to school on time for everyone." And he was arguing back and forth. And at the end, I just completely lost him. I was like, "Just get out of the car right now." And he was like, "Man, I hate this family." And it was really, it was actually a really bad moment for both of us. And so I felt really bad about it all day. And last night, we ended up having kind of like a family meeting because I called his mom and was like, "What is the deal with your son?" And she was like, I know, it's like, it's just getting worse." And so so we had this family meeting, and we decided that I was just going to leave at 8:05, and if he's not in the car, then he's not in the car. And that's something that we have, like, thought about, but we're worried that who knows what will happen then. He has to walk to school, but then it's still going to be late, but then he might forget to lock the door because he always does and leave a mess. And it's just like he's hard to manage. That's the thing his mother kept saying yesterday. He's a handful. He really is a lot to manage. And so this morning, I pull up to the house at 8:06 or whatever, and they're coming downstairs. And Georgia is standing in front of the house on the porch. And I'm like, "Come on, it's time to go." And Georgia, like, doesn't want to get in the car because she knows that I'm going to leave Ezra. And she's like, basically holding out for him. And I'm like, "Dude, get in the car." And she's like looking at her phone, and I roll down the window and I'm like, "Georgia." She's like, "Oh, huh? What?" And I'm like, "Get in the car." She's like, "Oh, okay." And she starts walking down the steps as slowly as humanly possible. And she finally gets in the car and she takes every possible, she stops to, like, literally stops and looks at a flower. And I'm like, "Oh my God," she's like, "she's blocking for him. This is actually amazing." And so she finally gets in the car, and he's not in. And I'm like, that's it. And I start the car and I'm pulling off. And then he comes running out of the house with his with one shoe in his hand and everything. And he's like at full speed, which I've never seen him operate full speed in the morning. So we got in the car and it was fine. And so I was thinking so much about that because it reminded me of this experience that I had once in college when I was at Tisch and I was assistant directing a production of All's Well That Ends Well with a New York director who I'm not going to say who his name was, but he actually no one freaking liked him. He was actually he was a fine director, but as a person, he was just a pain in the ass. And I remember it was that moment like, you know, like a week before opening and it was just that moment in the rehearsal process when everyone fucking hates everyone and no one can remember their blocking and people aren't off book and the director's yelling at everyone that we're terrible and he's never worked with such unprofessional actors and all this stuff. And during this one particularly tense moment in the rehearsal, the stage manager leans over to me and he goes, you know, the best things that can happen to a cast are a really good director or a really bad director. And I was like, I think about that to this day. That was like many, many decades ago that he said that. And I think about that because, you know, what he was saying is this thing about when a director like is really shitty, the cast bonds over their hatred of this person and they support each other because they're dealing with this shitty person. And in some ways, that's because Georgia and Ezra really bicker a lot and they do not really support each other that much. But this morning, she really supported him. And so, like, it was like a victory in that sense because that is the reason we had a second kid. Because Joe and I were like, no one kid should be exposed to us without support. We need, like, just like they need to have each other. That was literally one of our like guiding sort of rules. And yet the you know, like I lost it so bad yesterday that Georgia actually felt like she didn't want Ezra to miss. And so she like stepped up and supported him. And the whole thing was complicated. So on one level, it's a victory. But on another level, it's a fail because I was the bad parent. And it's going to take some time for me to recover from that and for him to recover from that. And we talked about it a little bit. And he was like, I get it. Like you were stressed and I'm not helping. And, you know, it's like, I'm sorry. And I was like, I'm sorry that I definitely lost it and I shouldn't have it. You know, what only 20% of it was you and the rest of it is just life stuff. And, you know, I'm sorry. And so, I mean, we got to a place, but I still feel really bad about it.
I have a question about the lateness part of it. Is it that he is going to be late, that he and Georgia are both going to be late, or that you are going to be
late? It's all of us.
Like what?
It's all of
okay,
us.
Okay, so all of you he are made, late like, for yesterday, required things if because of
yeah,
this.
Yesterday he made all of us late. Georgia got to school like 10 minutes, 20 minutes late. I ended up being a half hour late. I was supposed to actually speak at a school. I got there a half hour late. There's a bunch of fourth graders waiting for me. Like it was just... That's the reason I lost it because I was so
it's not arbitrary then. It's not
angry
just because
about
like he's not the only one being affected. It's like everybody. Okay.
Exactly.
Then I think leaving him behind is 100% the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, we're definitely leaving him behind if Georgia lets me.
Because it's like one of those things, like, you know, my friend was telling me this weekend that he thinks he's a terrible parent because he's always coming down on his son for things like leaving his things like on the living room floor or whatever. And he's coming to realize like it's kind of arbitrary. It's just not the way he would do it. Like his son, he thinks would pick it up later, but he's just like, why isn't he picking it up now? you know, and we sort of had this whole debate and, you know, actually they came from them listening to this podcast and he was just sort of following up with something that he'd heard me say. And I'm like, well, sometimes it is arbitrary. You just have to decide, like, is he just not doing what I would do? And then if he messes up, like, that's on him. But, like, if it's making everybody late, then it's not arbitrary.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And, I mean, there is. I try to stay away from that arbitrary stuff because I know a lot of kids, including myself, I know people grew up with this weird parental, like, just, like, micromanaging
control.
This like obsessive compulsive control, like why are you tying up the trash bag that way instead of this other way, and then getting all irritated about that. And even when I was a kid, I thought that was just so weird when I would go to other parents' houses and their dads, usually dads, sometimes moms, would do that. I would just be like, what the fuck is this guy's problem? And so I try not to do that, although I don't know how successful I am, but this is a different thing.
Well, my parents would die if they saw the way I still load the dishwasher. That's all I have to say about that. Dan, do you have a triumph?
Loading the dishwasher is like the clear example. It's the thing that I most have trouble like not micromanaging in my household because everyone so evidently does it the wrong way, but I recognize that it's not useful for me to point that out.
Yeah. Oh, it's a disaster. Like half the stuff gets clean in my dishwasher. All right, Dan. Would you have a triumph or a fail this week?
Well, I'll say that in a moment, but first I want to say to Carvel, I really want to know who the director was at Tisch who was so bad.
Me too.
You know what? Yeah. I'm not definitely
going to rhyme with.
And in fact, I'm not.
Booey Baymore?
Right. I actually don't even. That's a lot closer than you think. But the other problem I just realized when I was thinking about this story on the way over is I don't actually remember the guy's last name. So I'm going to put the whole thing. I'm going to put the whole thing beside.
Yeah. I got to see Carvel's Tisch training in action just the other day because I got to see Carvel perform on a stage at a book event that I invited him to. And he was great. He's a trained actor.
That was awesome.
And he is.
Crushed. I really loved that.
Crushed it.
Yeah, they actually the casting director like reached out and was like, "Do you want to maybe do this more?" I was like, "Yeah,
yeah." So it's your big break.
Yeah, I get my 15%. I can't wait.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, so my true fail, I've been away from home so much on this book tour, et cetera, that when I asked my kids if they had any suggestions for a specific parenting triumph or fail I could mention on the show, they both looked totally puzzled at the idea that I had parented at all. So that's the macro fail. But for the purposes of this podcast, I will choose something a little more micro, a micro triumph. And it's about our mornings. Sorry, Carvel. So at some point, my wife and I realized that so every morning, one of us gets up with the kids, and it's, you know, it's whoever draws the short straw that day. And we realized that every morning we would like drag our ass out of one of us would drag our ass out of bed and make them breakfast and make their lunch for school and like empty the dishwasher and hassle them to get ready, while like our kids were just like sitting at the table reading books. And this is a remnant, I guess, upon consideration of the way our mornings worked, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when they first started going to school, when we had, you know, a kindergartner and a second grader sitting at a table who were not that capable, say, of making their own breakfast or making their own lunch or even getting their shit together without like a lot of that kind of parenting micromanagement of, well, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have your iPad? Do you have your Friday folder? Do you have a coat? Is your water bottle full? And so my triumph is that in the last couple of weeks, we have managed to let go of this stuff a little bit. We have relaxed our iron grip on their mornings without sending the mornings into a tailspin of insanity. So, for example, our kids are now making their own breakfasts. Breakfast is the easiest meal in the world to make. It really involves no work, culinary skill, or anything. You don't really have to be able to operate any devices at all. You just have to be able to smear some butter on a bagel or operate a toaster or pour milk into a bowl. And unlike their second grade and kindergarten selves, they are capable of doing that. So now they do it. It's like we've Montessori'd them 6 years too late. But so that in turn has led to the mornings just being a lot simpler and feeling less like we are their servants waiting on them hand and foot and more like a collaborative effort to get going and get out the door. And it has not caused like them to be late or me to be half an hour late to talk to a bunch of fourth graders or whatever. So far, it is all holding together. Perhaps at some point they'll realize that this isn't like temporary, that we're going to expect them to make their own breakfast, in fact, for the rest of their lives, and they'll rebel. But for now, it is really holding, and we feel a tiny jolt of triumph each time we don't have to do that shit for them.
That's huge. That's not tiny. That's huge. Congratulations. Yeah,
I know. It's just it's tiny because it's so much later than it should have been. It should have happened like 3 years ago, which really dampens the triumph when we realize all the mornings we've ruined.
It's so hard. I mean, that's the hardest thing. Like, I can't square what I can do with my kids today versus what I have this mythical past that isn't that mythical. That is my own past and definitely my parents' past, where like there was no talking back to parents. There was, you know what I mean? It was just, there was nothing but work. You got up, you did the thing, and the parent, you know what I mean? And like this order that was kept, and like the way the kids learned work and responsibility through this kind of like through the parental micromanaging that I was just complaining about. That I like kind of like, isn't there a way I can do that without emotionally damaging my kids? Like, I'm trying to like figure that out because I really feel like I miss it.
I do want them to know that like there's a right way to do stuff. I just have to open myself up, I guess, to the notion that their wrong way could evolve into a right way. Not to like throw another theatrical metaphor into this, but you know, one thing that came up a lot in this book that I've been touring on, which is A History of Angels in America, Tony Kushner's play, is that Tony Kushner, the playwright, has had a huge problem not micromanaging every production for 25 years because, as he says, I know at least one way to make every single scene in the play work. And so it is like physically painful for me to watch actors go through their process, which is struggling to find their way to make the scene work. And it's hard for me to let go of that. But I think parenting is kind of like that. Like, you know, one way to make every single thing your kids are going to do work. Sometimes you have to let them find their own ways to make them work.
Right. And there's also this imagined future that if they don't do it your way, there's imagined future that they could have, which isn't a reality for them. That's your imagined future, not their imagined future. And that's like the tension, right? Well, that ties in nicely to my triumph so far that is probably going to turn into a fail later for this week, which is I've talked a little bit in the last few weeks about my kind of fraught relationship as a daughter with my own mother and, you know, trying to navigate that space between my parents and my kids. And, you know, they're old enough now where they like totally get it. Like, they get it. Like, my son Henry, who's in DC, my mom went to visit him a couple weeks ago, and then like he reported back about their conversation, and it was just as weird as a conversation like I would have with her, and like he was able to like nail down what was weird about it and all that. That being said, we all love each other, we all like want to do the right thing and so forth. So he, when she was visiting him, made the offhanded remark that she could maybe come, and he said, he used the word maybe, to his graduation from the Senate Page program. And of course, my mom never hears maybe. She only hears like, I'm booking my hotel room now because it's definitely happening, and I'm probably going to meet the president and every senator and be like in private tour of the Capitol. She hears what she wants to hear. So she was like, yes, I'm going to this. And so she texted me and she's like, Henry says I'm going. And I was like, whoa, wait, like, we don't even know the deal. We don't know how many like tickets he'll get, or, you know, get guests he'll be able to bring. I know it's in like a room, and, you know, Kevin and I are going down because we have to move him home that day. So it's going to be like, it's not going to be this like big thing. Like, it might be a nice thing, but then like we literally have to run back to his room, pack him up, run to the airport and fly home like 2 hours
after. We can't
do
a congratulatory dinner at the Palm.
Yes, exactly. That was like her first thing. It was like, oh, we can have dinner. I'm like, we cannot. So it's not going to be that. So I try to set the expectation. It turns out he sent me a note earlier this week that he gets 3 guests. And so I'm like, oh, God. Now it actually is a possibility that now I'm going to have to navigate the super tricky situation. So my mom starts texting me, like, have you heard how many guests it's going to be? Just like coincidentally, the same day he told me how many guests he had. And I was like, I don't know. I told a white lie. I was like, I still don't know how many guests there will be, but I will check. So I wrote Henry back and I was like, I need you to call me tonight because here's the deal. Like, we have to just discuss this because he says that there are some kids who have like big families who want to come. And so they need to tell them if they're not going to use all 3 because they can like put their tickets back in the pile. And I said, why don't we talk about it? I really want to find out if you really want grandma to come. Like, she should totally come. She obviously would like kind of make her year. But like, if you don't want her to, like, I'm happy to sort of run interference on that. So we just need to talk. And so I sent him that email, and then I immediately started feeling super guilty, like I am imparting my, like, the way that I manipulate and manage my mother thing, like, onto him and, like, having him, like, collude with me in it. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. So I started feeling really bad, and I started thinking, like, you know, just saying yes to this it will like mean so much to her that it'll probably be super easy to set all those other boundaries. And like, it'll probably like make her life and give her like stories to tell her old bitty friends like forever. Like, this is like a huge thing for her. So Henry called me that night and I picked up the phone and I was like, hey, you know, I wanted to talk to you about graduation. And he said, you know what, Mom, I was thinking, he's like, I know it's going to be tricky, but I feel like just saying yes will just be worth it in the long run for just like how, like, she'll just have these stories to tell her friends and we won't have to have this conversation about how she didn't get to go for the rest of my life. And I was like, oh, my God, triumph. Like, the collusion worked. That part's triumphant. But also, like, he gets it. Like, the guilt I felt about not just default doing the kind thing because of all the difficulty I know would go with it. Like, he was there ahead of me, and, like, he already had it. And I just thought, like, oh, thank goodness. Like, thank goodness that, like, we're just able to, like, say yes, like, be funny about it, like, see the humor in it, and just, you know, see how it goes. Now, of course, my, like, this might turn in a month or so. Like, there might be a whole fail segment about this decision. But I was just very proud of him for getting to that on his own and for being the kind of kid who understands that, like, sometimes just giving somebody what they want, even if it's more difficult for you, is like in the aggregate, like the right thing to do. I was very proud of that.
You've also given him an important head start on learning how he will eventually have to manage you when
That's
you become
right.
his crazy mother when he's like a full-fledged adult. So it's good that he's like getting that training now.
I have no illusions that that's not happening already. Like, no illusions. I get it. I get it. Like, I do think, you know, having a family is about, you know, learning to manage. It's just like work, right? Like, there are people that you work with and it's like, I know if I talk to this person this way, it'll go way better than if I talk to them that way. Like, you know, it's just nice when the kids start to figure it out. And I don't know. I'm just glad that he didn't say, like, you know, ultimately, you know, like, oh, God, it'll just be so difficult if, you know, we have to manage, you know, grandma wanting to, like, you know, come back to the room when we're just trying to pack. He didn't say any of that stuff. And that was the stuff I was worried that would worry him. And he just decided to let it all go. So I thought it was nice. I don't know. I don't know what it says about me and my selfishness, but he's obviously less selfish than I am, which is good.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some considered taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out their recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
As always, if you have a question you'd like us to answer on the podcast, leave us a message at 424-255-7833, or you can email us at momanddad@slate.com. And as a reminder, we've moved from a regular old-fashioned Facebook page to a Facebook group. The group is interactive. It's so much more fun and active, and every episode has a really rousing discussion. And there's a lot of other discussions, too, that people post there, triumphs, fails, commiserations. They ask for support. Plus, we ask group members sometimes if we can use their comments and dilemmas on the show. So just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. It's a really fun community. It is moderated, so it doesn't get crazy, and it even has Gabe enjoying Facebook. In today's
amazing.
Slate Plus,
truly
it's
amazing.
it's a miracle.
He's really
into social media.
He's
miracle.
Like the most active. He's the most active member of the entire community. So if you want a lot of Gabe.
It's
hello,
true. Slate it's parents.
No. Yeah, that's how you do the rest of the show, Dan.
Oh, that was like Gabe doing an impression of Mickey Mouse, basically.
That was
Mickey
like
Mouse
Gabe
doing
an impression,
of Gabe, actually.
Gabe doing
Ned
young
Flanders
Gabe.
Was what it was.
In Slate Plus today, Dan suggested we talk about an idea that's put forth in Sheila Hedy's new novel, Motherhood, that being a parent makes you more efficient at work. To hear segments like this and to get ad-free versions of the podcast, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is a great way to help support the show. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing Mom and Dad Are Fighting and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows, and a ton of other benefits. So if you want to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. All right, back to the show. Our first question was emailed to us at momanddad@slate.com. It's from Anne, and it's being read by Lena Wilson. She is Slate's browbeat intern.
Dear Mom and Dad, I've been a longtime listener and fan, and I'm finally finding the words to write this. I have one beautiful child, a second grade boy who's incredibly sensitive, empathetic, and a worrier. That leads to why I'm writing. I've struggled with and am being treated for severe anxiety and depression. While more often than not, it's relatively well controlled, I recently went through an extended period that left me unable to manage day-to-day life effectively. As a working mom, it was especially challenging to deal with the public versus private aspects of this condition, although I am working to defy the stigma. But my biggest concern is how it affects my child. The dilemma I face is my incredibly sensitive child has seen me in the throes of a major mental health crisis several times. I immediately seek professional help in these situations, but they don't always turn things around immediately. And when my son enters my darkened room to find me curled up in a fetal position, puffy-eyed, unshowered, and isolated, I worry so much about what having a mom who suffers like this is doing to him. I still give him lots of love and affection, read to him, ask him about his life, and even help with his homework when I can, but there are times it is really bad. I try to explain to him honestly that mommy doesn't feel well sometimes, in a way a 7-year-old can understand, but I'm so concerned about raising a kid who feels like he needs to take care of his mom. He will check on me constantly and kiss my forehead and ask me if I'm okay, and I just want to crumble with guilt. Anxiety and depression carry with them the symptom of feeling like an incredible burden to your family and friends. I'm lucky to have a husband that reminds me constantly of all the good I bring. But after this incredibly difficult year, I can't help but worry about how my mental health issues are affecting my child. Furthermore, I want to maintain at least a modicum of privacy, and I can only imagine every parent finding out that my son has a mom who could barely get out of bed for 2 weeks, and what prescription cocktail she's trying these days. But I suppose I have to let go of that and try my best to be proud of all I do to be a good mother despite these struggles. I love all your insights, and I would really love to hear your thoughts about this. You have a great show. Keep fighting the good fight, Anne.
Hi, Anne. This is Dan. Thank you for writing to us. This is really hard. You're absolutely right. And I really feel for you and what you're going through. I would start by saying that it is very clear to me that the most important part of the recipe for raising your son into the kind of person you want him to be is clearly there, which is your love and concern for him and your desire to be to do the best you can with him. Like, there's should be no question, I think, that what you want for him and what you can give him is the most important thing above any other problem that you think you might be causing. The love that you're giving him is crucial. Now, I come at this from the position of having a parent who did struggle with depression when I was a teen and who I did sometimes feel as though I had to take care of. Like, you can't deny that aspect of the parent-child relationship. But I don't think it is unique necessarily to someone who's struggling with these kinds of issues, right? There's what makes a family, ideally, is that everyone is always taking care of each other. And I think it's worth considering that as you think through, what these years are like for him and how he will remember them. It's worth noting, for example, that it didn't scar me forever. It didn't make me resent the parent who was struggling with these things when I was a teenager. I think, honestly, it helped instill some caregiving instincts in me. And I think I see greater empathy in myself as a result. It doesn't mean it wasn't hard for that parent, for me. But lots of hard things happen in our childhoods that aren't necessarily damaging, but that are instead things that we get through the same as we get through other stuff in our families. But I'd be really curious to hear what Carvel and Rebecca have to say as well.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much agree with what you said. I think that, you know, I always talk about putting things in order when there's a lot, when there's competing things that are vying for your attention and focus. Otherwise, it's just too hard to manage all of it. And I think it's true that it is hard for a kid, especially a young one, to feel like they have to take care of their parent emotionally. And like Dan, I also experienced that in pretty like extreme, maybe the word severe is applicable, ways when I was a kid. And yes, I'm sure it has helped with my emotional intelligence and has helped me do what I do now, which is to try and understand feelings and put them into words. And but I think it also did do some of the stuff that we're afraid it does. It makes kids grow up too fast. It makes them deny their own feelings because they feel like they have to manage other people's. It makes kids maybe sometimes into people pleasers because they're just trying to sort of do whatever they can to keep the caregiver from feeling bad. And they take on an outsized sense of responsibility for that. And all that stuff is very tragic and painful. Like, there's no doubt about it. And also what's happening is that you, the letter writer, are truly and indeed suffering from severe anxiety and depression that requires treatment. And that's just the facts of the case. And so there's not much you can do to stop that from happening other than to continue what you're doing. If we truly take mental health issues as the way they're supposed to be taken, as an actual health crisis, then it's the same thing as if you had cancer. And like, obviously, if a mother had cancer, this would be difficult in the kid. This would be very hard for the kid. This would do a lot of things in that kid's lives. But there'd be no part of us as a society that'd be like, well, just have less cancer because you're damaging your kid with your cancer. That's not how that works. And yep. I think underneath this letter is that social pressure that I think exists around mental health, that somehow we still treat mental health issues as though a person is like choosing to do this and they're not, they're, it's their fault and they're not, they just need to get it together and buckle up and, you know, and so I want to acknowledge that what the letter writer, I'm taking the letter writer at her word here, that what she's suffering from is a health issue. And so she has it and she must prioritize treatment of that issue over everything, because I do know that the extent to which you and your husband are there for your child, which sounds great, that's like the extent to which you deal with your mental health issues is the extent to which you can continue that. And your child does need that. And so in terms of priority, you already know this, but you have to prioritize thinking and worrying, if that's the right word, which probably isn't here, but attending to the continued treatment for that. And less important, and this is hard to say, but I think it's true in this case, less important right now is the impact on your kid of the times when your symptoms become so difficult as to be difficult to hide. That's, we don't like that. That's bad. But that's the second thing here. You can't prioritize that over dealing with your health, because your health has to come first, because that is indeed what allows you to be there for your kid. And there's not, and the other thing is that there's not much you can totally do about that. This is, you know, like your child will learn a lot of things about life over the course of their experience. And they will, as we all have, will continue to deal with those things. And the good news is there are resources for kids who have parents who suffer from mental health issues. Sometimes people don't find those resources until later in life, when they realize, you know, that they're having trouble in relationships or they're having trouble with their emotions, and they start peeling away the layers and they start realizing, oh, well, maybe this goes back to this thing I experienced when I was a kid. But there are places for that. There is therapy for that. There are groups for that. And so I think that, I guess what I'm saying here is, with regards to the kid, you have to do your best, but you have to accept the places where you're powerless over the impact of him. I don't want to say there's no impact, but I want to remind you that there's only so much you can do to control the impact. And the main place where you have power to positively affect that impact is the place where you continue to prioritize your own healing and treatment for this very serious issue. Your son has other people also who you're not the only person responsible for his emotional development. His father is there. A community is there. He will find more people as he goes, friends. He will continue to find his way through. And on some level, you have to trust that process. I guess those are my first thoughts on that.
You know, I've been thinking a lot listening to you guys talk, and then also when we first got this email about a couple of months ago, Lynn Lyons was on the show, and she was talking about anxiety in kids. And I'll tell you, I've shared that show with so many people because I really do think she did a wonderful job talking about how to talk to kids about the things that worry them. And I think that in this instance, I first of all agree with everything both of you have said, and all the notes I made, you kind of ticked off a lot of those boxes. You know, if you substituted the words cancer or diabetes for everything she says in here about mental health, it would feel like in some ways an easier question to answer, which means she might not have felt like she had to ask, right? Because, you know, she does talk about the symptoms, you know, being in the fetal position, unshowered, isolated, and, you know, that is not that different from what being physically ill looks like when you're really physically ill. It's just it's the causation that's different. And I do think drawing that very straight line, not just for you, but also for your son, could be key here. I mean, you describe him as incredibly sensitive, empathetic, and a worrier, and it sounds like you haven't given him a lot of information. And it may be time to have this conversation. You know, one of the things that Lynn said when she was on the show is that kids, especially anxious kids, and you didn't say specifically that your kid was anxious, but you did say he was a worrier. What causes worry and what triggers it very often is just they don't know what's going to happen. It's the unknown. You know, the not knowing how long something's going to last or what's going to happen when you get there or what happens if I, you know, wear the different pants than I expected to wear. And one of the big techniques she talked about and one of the things that I've been reading about since getting your email was that there does come a point, and a lot of the reading I did puts it like at 6 to 12 years of age, where you can be more specific about things like illness, about things like death, where you can say, you know, this is, you know, you can, beyond mommy doesn't feel well, you know, mommy has an illness that comes and goes. And, you know, yes, and when it comes, it's, you know, it's not just, you know, worrisome for you. It's also worrisome for me, but, you know, it doesn't mean I love you any differently. And you can have those conversations and be a little bit more, you know, age appropriately explicit, more transparency. Because I think, you know, what you're describing here is you're worried that your son is going to try to fix it and you know he can't. So what would happen if you told him that it's not his job to fix it, that he can't fix it, that it's your treatment that will, you know, provide the fix, and that all you need from him in the meantime and that all you want to give to him in the meantime is the same love that and support that you've always needed and given each other, and that sometimes that's easier for you and sometimes it's harder for you? I don't know. I think some transparency might really help allay some of this, like a real conversation. And that way, when it rolls around again, I don't know, your son may feel more empowered, more equipped. There might be some things that you can write down for him that he can refer to. The other thing I wanted to address is that you talk about other parents finding out and, you know, the privacy you feel. And again, I would say if it were diabetes, if it were cancer, would that be the same for you? If so, and you're just really private about your personal life and your health, that's a different conversation. But I think what you're saying here is that as much as you know about the stigma and you're trying to address it, you're also a little bit of a victim of it. And maybe that's what's keeping you from talking to your son more. You don't want him to go to school and tell his teacher or tell a friend. I do think you should let that go. I really do. And I think that if I don't know what a worst case scenario would be, if you believe people were talking about you, if you, you know, got a phone call from a teacher, you could just be really honest and transparent with another adult. And, you know, I don't know. I think that may be kind of what's driving a lot of this worry for you. And I would want you, if I were your friend, I would tell you, how can I help you let that part go? Like, what is it? What would it take? You know, do we need to play out the worst case scenario if people found out? Do we need to, you know, worry about people would look at your son differently? Like, what would that look like? And, like, really work through it, because it's not good, and it's not good to have that fear kind of underlying all of this.
I mean, the worst case scenario is bad. I mean, that's the thing that I worry about, and that's why that part of her email, you know, I struggled with that a little bit, right? I don't want her to and to feel as though she has some obligation to defy the stigma, like to fight that battle right now too, in addition to all the other battles.
Right.
And
right.
you know, there is a real cost. I mean, this is like a gross way to put it, but there is a cost to being the kid with like the parent who's having trouble like that. And I just don't know exactly what the right tack to take is or what advice to give, in as much as, you know, as someone, you know, people are going to know that things are happening in your house. It's not something that you can keep secret, nor should you necessarily keep it secret. And you don't want it to be stigmatized, but at the same time, one way that kids who are in these situations suffer sometimes is because they take shit about it from their classmates, or, you know, it makes the world outside the home difficult in addition to the world inside the home. So I guess I would ask you guys, like, how should she manage this public-private part of it? I agree that being clear with him is important, but how do you manage that public-private thing? Even if you know that if you substituted the word cancer, it wouldn't make any difference. You know that, but you still have an entire community of people around you, some of whom are going to be dicks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the worst case scenario actually is like, I mean, not that this is likely, but this is the biggest fear, is like some kind of CPS intervention or some like social way in which it publicly is like, she's publicly pronounced unfit to parent, the scarlet letter. Like, that is the worst case scenario. Not saying that's likely to happen, but that's the thing that if I was in the situation, that would be the kind of like ghost, this sort of Babadook in the closet that I would be panicked about. And so, I mean, it's funny what you say, Rebecca, about, because that part too, also, I really sat with that and I had thoughts about it, but they weren't even formed enough for me to say it when I was first talking. But hearing you say what you said, you know, the other thing I think there is a stigma. It's real. And the first thing I would say about that is that this woman probably knows her community better than we do. In some communities, I think, for example, in the community that I live in, a parent with mental health issues is probably going to meet with enough sympathy and understanding that to have it be public or known isn't going to be like intensely damaging necessarily, at least to the parent. I can't vouch for so much for the kids. My kids are really, they always tell me that there's kid world and adult world and the rules are all different and the adults don't understand kid world. And I think they're right about that. And so I can't say too much about what I know about what would happen in the kid world if, say, Joe or I like had mental health issues and they were public. But I do know that, I mean, we do, but severe ones. And like, I think that the reality, I think this person knows their community better. And if you know that you live in a judgmental, sort of like not like a community that is in no way understanding of this kind of stuff, then if you know that's what it is, because you're around, you talk to the parents, you talk to people after school and after drop off, you know what kind of stuff gets said. If you feel like this is not a safe place for that, I would encourage you to listen to that. However, I would also say that there's the possibility. The one thing that we never consider when we talk about going public with our struggles, and this is something that comes up for me a lot as a writer, is that I am always pleasantly surprised, not by how regular people react, but how other people who have the same struggle come forward and how my being honest helps them and allows them to be honest. And so, you know, I think one way of splitting the difference is, this person didn't mention it in the letter, but I hope that they have one place, one friend where they can, outside of the home, where they can be completely honest about what's going on, who's understanding, at least one, because it's very difficult to feel that you have to hold all this stuff internally. That's like an added level of suffering in addition to the actual illness. And if there is some place, some friend, some mom friend, some parent friend that you feel like you can open all this up to and be honest and that they're understanding, that's a really good thing. And I would lean into that. It doesn't mean you have to tell everyone or like make an announcement on like the parenting Facebook board or whatever, because I also think that, you know, and this I'm really reading into this letter from my own experience. This was never mentioned, but my experience is that a nuclear family gets a lot of stress put on it. We're talking about a small family. And so if your husband or partner is the only person who is holding all of this, that's probably going to wear thin the kind of balustrades of that relationship too over time, not necessarily a predicting like damage or demise, but that's a lot of stress for one partner to have to carry in addition to having to parent the kid and keep things together and deal with the house and also to be worried about how to help you and also to do whatever it is that he has to do in his life, his job or his friend group or whatever. So that's another reason to, if you can find another person that you can be fully honest with, then that's a great thing. That's a great relationship to develop. Also, in the other super practical thing is that in those times you need help. In those times when you're curled up in a fetal position, you need help. You need someone to come in that house and say, hey, little kid, I'm taking you to the park. Hey, come with me. We're going to go shopping. Hey, come with me. I'm going to take you. I got to go to the DMV. You'll come with me and you can play games on my phone. It's going to be great. You need that because that is, it's just too much for two people to carry on their own.
And I don't think that she should feel guilty about it. I mean, this is the thing. It's that
this is
what is driving this email. And she says it like a couple of times is like these a lot of guilt and a lot of fear. And, you know, I know a parent of a teenager who's really suffers from a very severe eating disorder. And she's had to go into treatment a couple of times, inpatient and outpatient. And I know about it. Because I know about it, not because, you know, it's like, I don't know if she knows that I know about it. It's sort of one of those oblique things that somebody told me and I know. And so because I know, I try to be supportive in other ways that aren't overtly like, hey, I know you, whatever. But it is, I know, because I know her well enough that so much of her communication around the times that, you know, whether the kids need rides or whatever, it's wrapped up in this like incredible amount of like burdening other people, guilt stuff, which is exacerbated because she feels like she can't just say what's going on, right? She just can't say it for, you know.
Yeah.
And I think developing community is good, but that's also, you can get a lot of that, I think, from really, really great treatment programs. You can be in groups. You can have a network. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like she's starting from a good place here in so far as that, you know, she has this illness. She also has a really wonderful family. And I think, I don't know, the son being seven, I know seven sounds really young if you're a parent of a seven-year-old and that's your oldest child. And I think that seven is one of those ages that, in my experience, even just being on this show, that people just tend to underestimate what kind of information a seven-year-old can understand thoughtfully that won't, that it actually hurts them more to not have the information. And I don't know. I just think it might be time to think about that a little bit. All right. Well, Anne, thank you for sending your email. In your email, you said, keep fighting the good fight. I think we all would share that sentiment with you. Keep fighting the good fight. And if you want to respond to our response to Anne's question, check out the Slate Parenting Facebook group. I imagine there's going to be a lot of discussion around this topic when we post the episode there. And if you would like to send us a note, you can send us a note at momanddad@slate.com. Or, of course, you can always call 424-255-7833. All right, it's time for recommendations. Dan, what have you got for us this week?
This week I am recommending a YA mermaid pop music anime adventure. It's called Lou Over the Wall.
Of course you are. Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
I wanted to cram it all in my one episode. It's called Lou Over the Wall. It's a film, a Japanese film that is coming to theaters this month. It's opening this week in New York and then spreading to other cities over the next month. It is a totally insane spin on The Little Mermaid from a wild Japanese anime director named Masaki Yuasa. It's about a moody kid who has just moved from Tokyo to a tiny fishing village. And he doesn't have any friends, really. And the only thing he likes to do with his time is make beats and post them to the internet. But two of his classmates find out about this, and they ask him to join their band. And the band rehearses out on abandoned Merfolk Island, of course. And then their little band of three is soon joined by a fourth band member who has the tail of a fish. And when she makes music, humans are forced to dance. It is totally silly. It is psychedelic. It is really gorgeous. adore just to look at. It's like one of the most beautiful movies I've seen in a long time. It is a great, truly weird movie for truly weird tweens and teens who are into kawaii stuff. Again, it is called Lou Over the Wall. Look for it.
All right. Carval, what about you? What have you got?
I'm recommending a Facebook video about the making of paper. That's it. Very straightforward. It's just amazing. It's about a, oh, I don't know, 5-minute video about that shows one woman making paper from scratch. She cuts down a tree. And then the video just watches slowly as she goes through every single process of the paper making. It's really phenomenal and transfixing and bizarrely amazing. And it just does, we're in a situation where we, so many things that exist in our world, they just appear, especially for kids. They feel like things just pop up. They just go to the store and there everything is. And this just is a good way to open up discussions about where things come from and how things get made. And there's just something really beautiful about it. So we'll post that to the Slate page, obviously. And that's my recommendation.
That sounds really great. I'm going to start making
really
my kids make their own paper in the morning before they go to
school. There you go.
That's right. They're in school supplies. You need school supplies? We're going to make them. mine is a little more of a lowbrow version of that. I'm going to recommend a TV show that whenever it kind of comes back or we see it on demand, even though my kids are older teenagers now, there's plenty there for all of us, just as there was when they were much, much younger. The new version of it is called BattleBots. Its previous iteration was called Robot Wars. These are teams of dorky engineer types who have made robots designed to destroy each other, and they have this big, very flashy Vegas-like venue, which I believe might even be in Vegas, where they put these robots up against each other, and they have a bracket tournament, and there's a little bit of tech stuff in there, and there's a little bit of strategy stuff in there, lots of human drama. There is a titch, I will warn you, of slightly toxic bro engineer masculinity in there, but ultimately, it's kind of overcome, and spoiler alert, because a lot of those guys don't end up winning the robot wars or the battle bots. So we really love this show. It's silly. It's fun. It's in the category of things you can watch when you don't have a whole lot of time. And everyone in our house like is able to tolerate it, if not actually like super duper enjoy it. It kind of crosses age groups and crosses interest groups. And it's just a lot of fun. So you can find it on demand a lot of places. It's called BattleBots. And there was an old version of it called Robot Wars. And we watched
great
them both.
Yeah.
I thought you would think that was lowbrow.
No. Well, I mean, it is, but it's great. It fits the exact niche of I have 22 minutes and I want everyone in the family to do something together. And what the fuck are we going to do?
Yeah.
To just be staring at something.
It's perfect.
All right. Well, that'll do it for us this week. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Benjamin Frisch. The homepage for the show is slate.com/momanddad. If you have a question you want to ask us on the show, leave a message at 424-255-7833. You can also join us on Facebook by searching for Slate Parenting on Facebook, and you can have a lot of interactions with Gabe there. For Carvel Wallace and Dan Coyce, I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and we will talk to you next week.